Hello and welcome to The Curator on Monaco 24 with me, Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Over the next 60 minutes, we'll be bringing you some of the very best interviews and reports from the past week of coverage here on Monaco 24, with highlights from our studios here in Midori House and from around the world. This week, the actress Jane Fonda looks back on a lifetime of activism and reveals how, with a consequential presidential election looming, her work is far from done.
I couldn't get into it because there was nothing to hold on to. My hands were behind my back and the step was high up. And so the officer had to take my fanny and push me into the police wagon. That was a little unceremonious. This is my new normal.
Plus, top London chef Laura Jackson shares a favorite recipe.
I've roasted a lot of chickens in my life, so I think by now I think I've got the recipe down to a T. It's a great one to cook at home because it is so simple and it's a crowd pleaser, so it's quick to prepare.
All that and much, much more over the next hour here on The Curator with me, Fernando Augusto Pacheco. And what a better way to begin this week's show than with a big interview, and they do not come much bigger than this. Jane Fonda has lived an extraordinary life. She was born in New York in 1937 and has starred in nearly 50 films since making her debut in 1960, earning her rafts of awards, including 2 Academy Awards for Best Actress. She is, however, arguably as well known for her activism as she is for her performances in film and television. From opposing the Vietnam War to hosting fundraisers in Hollywood for the Black Panther civil rights movement in the 60s and 70s, to launching her famous series of home workout videos in the early 80s in order to finance the Center for Economic Democracy, the body she co-founded to end economic injustice in the U.S. The ways in which she has campaigned are as diverse and as varied as the causes she has championed. And last October, she began what she describes as the final chapter of her activism, which began just before her 82nd birthday. Fire Drill Fridays began as a series of rallies and protests in Washington, D.C., in which she and some of her fellow demonstrators were arrested week after week. A consequential presidential election, she says, means that her work in activism is far from done. Monaco's Thomas Lewis spoke to Jane Fonda from her home in Los Angeles for the big interview.
The demonstrations, the protests, the uprisings after the protests were thrilling to me. Thrilling in their breadth and depth and diversity. I mean, there's a small town just south of where I'm living. It's all white, middle class. And they were out carrying Black Lives Matter signs. There's something about this moment that got people out into the streets, not just that they've been shut up for so long, but the pandemic has pulled the Band-Aid off the profound systemic injustice and inequality in this country. I don't think people really realized, many people didn't realize how close to the edge most Americans live, just literally paycheck to paycheck. And how these are the people that we rely on to keep life going, the delivery men, the postal service, the nurses, the teachers, the home care workers, et cetera. And there's been a new appreciation, I think, of the need to address inequality and the need to create good jobs where people in the United States, the fact that so many people live in constant anxiety that they won't be able to feed their family, that's inexcusable. In this country. And things have only gotten worse as neoliberalism has been at work here in the United States. So there's that. And then, you know, when we started Fire Drill Fridays in DC, we didn't know whether there was going to be traction. You know, I kind of thought, well, the young people have the Sunrise Movement and the Fridays for Future and Extinction Rebellion and Zero Hour, and we need something for old folks. You know, it took about three or four, it took almost a month before we realized, holy cow, we've tapped into something really important. People started coming from all over the country. They wanted to be told what they can do. They wanted to be told, here's something you can do that's not so difficult. And then to take that next step and put their bodies on the line, engage in civil disobedience and risk arrest. And it had profound transformative effects on people.
And it seems that that had a transformative effect on you too. Is that fair to say?
Yeah. You know, in this day and age, in your country like in mine, it's not so easy to have the experience or find a way to put your whole self in alignment with your deepest values, which is what civil disobedience does. It's like stepping into yourself. Very empowering. Now, obviously, it helps to be white and famous. You know, the police were told to behave well. If I'd been black, it would have been quite different. But it was, you know, for historic reasons, most of the people who got arrested were white. There was maybe two hands full of, maybe there were 10 African-American people in the course of the 4 months, and I understand why. But our goal was to reach people who understand that there's a climate crisis, understand that it's human created, and just want to know what to do. And that's what happened. And most of them, when we asked, often we did, have any of you ever done this before? Most hands went up. This is something they'd never done. So that was really rewarding. And do you know that last weekend we had 600,000 people following Fire Drill Fridays on Zoom?
I didn't know that. That's incredible.
And Facebook and Twitter and Instagram. And the week before we also had Sirius XM. So it's growing, and like 1,000 people signed up as volunteers. It's pretty exciting.
And can you take us back, Jane, to that first Fire Drill Friday? You describe in this very sort of stark detail the moment when your hands were placed behind your back by a police officer on the steps of the Capitol building in Washington, D.C., and that feeling of your sort of inner motivations and your physical self being at one for one purpose, which I thought you described really beautifully in the book. Can you recall that moment for us?
Well, I have been handcuffed before and put in jail before, but they were metal and I was younger. Now I'm almost 83 and they were white and they were painful and they put my arms behind my back and I have shoulder issues. So, it was hard, but I knew why I was there. I knew what I wanted to accomplish. I knew there would be a lot of press coverage. And my goal was to, people were going to say, well, my God, she's 82. And if she can do that, I can do that kind of thing. And I felt so empowered, not so empowered when we got to the police wagon and I couldn't get into it because there was nothing to hold on to. My hands were behind my back. And the step was high up, and so the officer had to take my fanny and push me into the police wagon. That was a little unceremonious. This is my new normal.
Jane Fonda there in conversation with Monocle's Thomas Lewis for this week's edition of The Big Interview. And Fonda's new book, What Can I Do? My Path from Climate Despair to Action, is published by Penguin Random House and is available now. We're going to stay in the cultural realm and with the US now for a highlight from this week's installment of Monocle on Culture. As David Byrne's hit Broadway show American Utopia arrives on screens in a new film by Spike Lee, Robert Bound was joined by the film critic for The Telegraph, Tim Robey, and over in New York, pop culture journalist Hilary Hughes to discuss Byrne's history of revolutionizing live performance, Lee's imprint on the show, and its relevance in the current political climate. Here is a highlight.
Talking about statements, there's a part in the show, sort of 3/4 of the way through, when David Byrne says to the audience, well, I'm going to play a song now that is written by Janelle Monáe. And I rang her up and I said, are you okay with me doing this? It's a protest song and I'm a white dude of a certain age. And she was like, this song is for all of humanity. It's called Hell You Torn About. And this is a song written in solidarity, or it's been linked to solidarity with Black Lives Matter. That's a pretty powerful moment. And it's a kind of call and response thing with the audience as well. Hilary, how does that sit in the context of this kind of pop concert film?
I was thinking about that a lot this morning and how what I appreciated about that was, some people go to the theater or go to a show for escapism. They want to be taken out of the current moment. They want to be taken out of, our reality or what we're living through. And no, that is not what we're doing here. And I appreciate that in 2020, some of the most brilliant art, most of it, grounds you in this moment and makes you confront it. And I appreciated that David, worked that into the show, and specifically, you know, not only went to Janelle and used her work, which is so powerful, but interpreted it in his own way. And I also love that this was the part of the show that felt like a true Spike Lee joint to me in terms of his style and what we've seen in his movies, and specifically the tributes to, you know, to these these people who were murdered, you know what I mean? And I think that in and of itself is something that in the United States we have been thinking about a lot in the last, you know, for unfortunately way too long. And yeah, you just sit with it. And I think that you're able to with this, but at the same time, you're very much in that moment. And it's a very cathartic experience. And clearly I'm rambling. I could talk so much about this, but
you just made me realize something though about Spike Lee's style in that sequence. Absolutely quite right. Spike Lee loves to break away from his films and give us moments of photographic montage or, you know, cutaways to real things. Even in a fictional feature like To Five Bloods, we cut away to kind of real footage quite a lot. And in that song, he cuts away to, you know, photos of these murdered Black Americans, sometimes with family members holding them. And it's that montage is incredibly powerful. And it's pure Spike Lee, absolutely. And it really was not like that on stage when I saw it. There was no visual, if you like, to accompany the song, other than just watching the band and watching David Byrne. And I do think that whole sequence stands out brilliantly.
Yeah, there is the small matter next month of the presidential election.
just tiny, just a small matter. Not small, the fate of the world or anything.
Small bump in the road. And David Byrne, I don't know whether he has forever been very interested in getting people out to vote, but there is quite a lot of that in the film. In fact, I think that's kind of partly his send-off at the end of it. I mean, Hillary, as an American, as a voter, does that ring just as true as the Janelle Monáe song and the Black Lives Matter thing? For me, it felt like he was wearing his political convictions lightly, but with great conviction. If you know what I mean, it is not thrust down your throat, because it is bookmarked by such kind of joy.
Absolutely. And I think that this is another example of David using his platform for good. I think that we have a massive problem here in the United States of people not showing up to vote and people thinking that, you know, oh, I live in a state that's going to go either, you know, completely Democratic or completely Republican. I don't need to participate in this election. I don't need to participate in the midterms. It's not that important. It's not, you know, we're not electing the next president. No, clearly we've seen in recent history that, you know, a lack of involvement or interest is catastrophic. And I think that David, you know, mentioning that he had someone from Headcount, which is an organization that registers people to vote, at concerts and live events, that he was like, hey, listen, go talk to these people. You can register to vote at my show. That makes it accessible to people. And it makes it, you know, it reminds someone, hey, maybe I should check my voter registration. Because here, unfortunately, we have an issue where it's pretty common for voters to be expunged from the rolls and to not realize that until it's too late. And so, you know, he's not telling you how to vote. He's just, you know, reminding you of your civic duty in a way that's really approachable.
Yeah, yeah. And he does a nice trick with the audience. As I say, there's little sort of audience interaction, as it were, or fixation on the audience, as Tim was saying, as a film. But he does a nice thing with the lighting, where he shows the mere percentage of the audience that voted in, I think it's a local election or whatever. And it is startling, and you know, to look at that whole theatre and think of just a little narrow strand of people that were voting there. He does it. It's classy.
That's classy and very, very skillful. And I think probably, yeah, unique to the Broadway version of the show. It's also pragmatic, as you were saying. It's not just kind of rhetoric and words. It's actually like, right, here's something you could do today if you haven't registered. Here it is. We're going to make that possible. And just to close the book on Hell You're Talking About as well, I would say one thing to add to that is that song was written in 2013. And I think the film powerfully makes the point that sort of the most tragic thing about it is how many names you would have to add to that song now if you were writing that song in 2020. Obviously, sort of top of the list, George Floyd this year. And for this film to be out, for Spike Lee to have filmed it this year of all years, it really kind of makes about the maximum impact it possibly could.
Absolutely. Well, and something to kind of speak to the political nature of the show as well. I think a very organic way that David approached this is he just introduced the people that he was with on stage. And he also mentioned, hey, I'm a naturalized citizen. I moved here from Scotland when I was four. This is a stage full of immigrants. You know what I mean? And this is something that I think was very important for him to say, and something that I appreciated him saying, because New York City is a global city, but that audience isn't necessarily a global audience. I mean, like, Broadway is a huge tourist draw, you know what I mean? So if someone from the Midwest is coming to see the guy that they love in the Talking Heads, you know what I mean, and coming to see the show, they're, again, they're going to be faced with something maybe that they didn't expect, but hopefully they were affected by it either way.
Hilary Hughes there and Tim Robey speaking to Robert Bowne for this week's edition of Monaco on Culture. Staying with the US elections now for our next highlight. Donald Trump and Joe Biden shared a stage on Thursday night for the final presidential debate before the election on the 3rd of November. The 90-minute debate held in Nashville, Tennessee, was divided into six 15-minute segments, with each candidate giving 2 uninterrupted minutes before they entered into open debate. The important difference from the first debate, which was filled with interruptions, was that only the candidate who had the floor had their microphone turned on. The other was temporarily muted. So, did that stop the mudslinging and interrupting that we saw in the first debate? Well, for Friday's edition of The Globalist, Georgina Godwin was joined on the line by Brian Klass, assistant professor in global politics at UCL and co-author of How to Rig an Election. But first, heard a report from Monaco's US election correspondent, Thomas Lewis.
Well, firstly, it was a totally different proposition to the first presidential debate that took place in Cleveland, Ohio, back at the beginning of the month. Both candidates, I think, performed much better than they did on that occasion. Donald Trump played by the rules a lot more this time around, but he'd obviously come prepared to say the things that his team and his campaign felt that he should say. So I think the main things among that strategy was to try and pitch Trump as this kind of outsider. At one point, he looked at Joe Biden and said, "You're the reason that I ran for president in the first place," saying that Joe Biden's 47 years at the top level of US politics was the problem with US politics and US life at the moment. I think that was slightly undone by the fact that he has been president for 4 years now. So slightly intriguing that he felt that this kind of slightly more free-flowing persona would chime with voters who maybe weren't considering voting for him before. Joe Biden had a very good performance, I think it's fair to say. He really got a lot of time in to put a lot of detail into things, and he also sustained his attacks on President Trump. Even when there were moments of interruption, he managed to sort of rebound and recalibrate his arguments pretty successfully, I think. There is a moment at the end of the debate that Donald Trump's campaign has said it will make much of, and that is that Joe Biden said in perhaps more explicit terms than he'd intended to, that he would gradually aim to phase out the oil industry in the United States. I think a lot of those who support a sort of climate-led agenda in US government would see that as inevitable, but perhaps the way Biden said it was a little more blunt than maybe he'd intended. We'll see what impact that has, if that is now a line of strategy by the Trump campaign going forward to Election Day. What they tried to lean very heavily on tonight was on Hunter Biden, Joe Biden's son. It felt as though those moments weren't particularly successful, given that it just made it seem like the president wasn't necessarily interested in government in the country, but more on personality politics and getting one over on his rival. So it will be interesting to see what the sort of immediate polling after the debate is, because I think there's a sense that it won't have shifted the needle too much at all, but that it was a much better debate by both candidates the first time around. We'll just have to see whether certain points, either on the separation of children at the border, the handling of the coronavirus pandemic, or indeed this idea of the oil industry, whether any of those become this kind of major talking point in the days to come following today's debate. And if that is the case, perhaps then we will see some movement in the opinion polls. But the sentiment, I think, is that there won't be some huge bombshell moment that will really change the course of things, particularly given that more than 40 million Americans have already voted and have already made their choice.
That was Thomas Lewis talking immediately after the debate last night. And listening to that with me is Brian Klass, who's Assistant Professor in Global Politics at UCL and co-author of How to Rig an Election. Brian, what did polling after the debate say?
Well, it's very preliminary, and we haven't gotten reliable polling yet, because they do these sort of flash polls, which show varying results. But I think the key is that this was not a game changer. And that's what President Trump needed this to be. He needed this to be something that reset the race completely. And this wasn't that. You know, it's like doctors pledge to first do no harm. A candidate with a big lead in the polls needs to stick to that mantra. And Biden did no harm last night. And I think that is the big takeaway. And it's the last moment in which Trump had an opportunity to actually change the course of the race, because now until November 3rd, there's just going to be rallies. There's not going to be any sort of major events that Biden and Trump will square off in. And that means that the polls, as we see them now, are probably going to be what it looks like going into Election Day.
The New York Times comes up with at least 25 facts that Trump mentioned that were inaccurate. What can you tell us about what are, I mean, we're calling them inaccurate facts. Lies is the word I'm looking for.
Yeah, I mean, there was a series of the constant ones that Trump brings up, you know, the stuff about Hunter Biden that is not rooted in reality, the discussion of climate change, wind turbines, Trump saying that he is the least racist person in the world, you know, stuff like this, which is just, it's beyond the pale. It's obviously untrue. But this speaks to a broader strategy from the debate and Trump's campaign in general, is that he has typically campaigned for his base, for people who already believe what he says. And, you know, this is something that's not a very good strategy, because he needs to win beyond the base. And so these things that he says that are untrue, they work for people who already believe him. They don't work for people who are not already converts to the campaign. And that's a real problem for Trump, because he can't win with the base alone. It's simply impossible for him. It's not a big enough group of people. And so, you know, he's in a situation where, again, you know, the strategy that he's adopted for the last 6 months has not been a winning one. And that's why it's not likely that he's going to win on November 3rd.
Mm. Brian, your book is called How to Rig an Election. And Donald Trump is alleging that this election is already rigged. New York Times and others now reporting that Russia and Iran have also tried to meddle in the democratic process. And we know there's a great deal of fake news out there. Is this going to be a fair election?
Well, there's two categories of manipulation. One is the category that is false, which Trump is alleging, and that's voter fraud and mail-in ballot fraud. And that's going to be very rare, as it always is in U.S. politics. There's another aspect of election manipulation that is real, and that is voter suppression. And that is happening, right? There are long lines to vote, disproportionately long lines in heavily African-American neighborhoods by design, things like this, which are, you know, very problematic about U.S. elections. But this election is not substantially different from other elections in terms of its integrity. So, you know, I think Trump, if he loses, will probably say that it was rigged based on no evidence. And that will be a very big problem for the U.S. as a whole if the election is close. If the election is not close, if it's a landslide, nobody will believe President Trump, and it won't really matter that much. So I'm looking for what the margin is on November 3rd, and I'll be much, much more worried if it comes down to one or two states and the margin is razor thin.
Brian Klass there, assistant professor in global politics at UCL and co-author of How to Rig an Election. And before that, Monaco's Thomas Lewis in conversation with Georgina Godwin for Friday's edition of The Globalist. Staying with Thomas now for our next highlight. The Green Party of Canada elected a new leader a little more than 2 weeks ago. Annamie Paul is a former lawyer and a relative newcomer to national politics, but she is the first woman of color to lead a national political party in Canada. And while the Greens have only 3 members in the country's parliament, the party's presence has been growing in local and provincial legislatures during the past few years. Monaco's Toronto bureau chief Thomas Lewis spoke to Annamie Paul in Toronto last week on her ambitions for Canada's Green Party, and she began by outlining her own experience and how it might frame her approach as the Green Party's new leader.
My story is definitely an immigrant story here in Canada. My mom and my grandma came here as domestic workers, which is really the only way that Black women could come to Canada back then. And they were both already skilled professionals, but that's how you could come. And we lived incredibly modestly, because a lot of money, you know, you make money, but then you send it back home to just a million people. And so I grew up very modestly, but in a place where, well, in a family where that had high expectations, and in a place where it was entirely possible for someone with my background to get a great education and then to have an affordable post-secondary education. And so both of those things are harder now. And that's a big problem.
The leadership election to succeed your predecessor, Elizabeth May, who had been the leader of Canada's Green Party for 14 years or so, that was a crowded field, and it was a process that was drawn out by the coronavirus pandemic, among other things. What effect do you feel that had on your own campaign and then on your victory back at the beginning of this month?
For us, when the pandemic hit, we immediately pivoted because for me, you know, I haven't been in politics long, but it's one of the things that it's very important for people to remember, and certainly I want to never forget it, is that, you know, people need to remember we are part of the community, you know, we're not apart from it. So if people are having, and the people they love are having difficulties because of the pandemic in terms of their employment, in terms of seeing their elderly parents, if they're in long-term care, in terms of all the things we were panicked about, it affected me as well. And so I said to our campaign team, the only logical way that we can continue with this campaign and not call for it to be suspended is if we are contributing positively to the conversation about how to get through this moment and then what comes afterward. And so we spent a lot of time in the first, let's say, 4 months of the campaign talking about that, and particularly about how to prevent people from falling through the cracks, the people that still were not going to be covered by these benefits. And other things, you know, for instance, asylum seekers. I mean, we've closed our border to asylum seekers coming via the United States, and that to me is unconscionable. And so that was the role that I said we could play. And so that's what we did. And then toward the end, you know, when things had stabilized, we went back to the climate emergency and the environment and talking about that. So the two big parts were how we can address the gaps in our social safety net and finally complete it. And the other big part was how we can deal with this existential crisis, which is the climate emergency.
And your election to lead Canada's Green Party has marked several firsts for a leader of a national political party in Canada. What's your hope that the breaking of some of those boundaries, the creation of some of those firsts, as you have done in your election to the leadership, what do you think that might mean for politics in Canada, national politics in the years to come?
You know, the research tells us it makes a difference. It's not just a sensation that people have. People associate themselves and participate in institutions where they see themselves reflected. And so having someone like me in a position like this makes it possible for those people who did not see that before, who couldn't imagine it before, to actually imagine it. And that's really, really important in a country as diverse as Canada. It's really important for the health of our democracy. It's one of the things that we just have to confront and really grapple with. We have to ask ourselves why in 2020, I'm only the fifth woman to lead a major federal party. Only the fifth. We're talking about 52% of our population who has only had five leaders. And so this is an area, it's one of our final frontiers in politics, and it is as impenetrable in general as it has been in the United States. We like to think of ourselves as being different in that respect, but we absolutely are not. We just simply are not. We're going to do what is necessary to make all people in Canada feel welcome and included in politics. And this helps. This definitely helps, not just in terms of the Green Party, but it helps in general.
Anna Meepaw there, the newly elected leader of Canada's Green Party, speaking to Monaco's bureau chief in Toronto, Thomas Lewis. As it's the end of the week, it's time for Monaco's contributing editor, Andrew Muller, to share his reflections on what we know this week that we didn't 7 days ago. It's time for this week's What We Learned.
We learned this week that, quite contrary to appearances, not all of American politics has descended into irrecoverably entrenched partisan name-calling, hair-pulling and bun-throwing. In Utah, that's the state song popping cheerfully away in the background, there was a heartening outbreak of seemliness as the rival candidates for governor, Democrat Chris Peterson and Republican Spencer Cox, appeared in an ad together which was kind of a campaign spot for each other.
I'm Chris Peterson.
And I'm Spencer Cox.
We are currently in the final days of campaigning against each other to be your next governor.
And while I think you should vote for me...
Yeah, but really you should vote for me.
There are some things we both agree on.
We can debate issues without degrading each other's character.
We can disagree without hating each other.
And win or lose, in Utah, we work together.
So let's show the country that there's a better way.
My name's Chris Peterson.
And I'm Spencer Cox.
And
we approve this message.
We further learned upon taking a long, hard look at polling for Utah's gubernatorial race that the Democrat Peterson had little to lose in agreeing to this demonstration of goodwill, so fair play especially to presumptive Governor-elect Cox, and maybe you should bear this in mind next time one of his co-religionists ruins your bath by knocking on your door and attempting to interest you in the prophecies encoded in ancient Egyptian text found on gold plates in 19th century New York State and translated via a talking rock in a hat. The Mormons, very arguably the world's least annoying evangelists. We will be returning to the intersection of religious prophecy and American politics later in this monologue, so this bit also works as a clever and subtle exercise in foreshadowing.
I'm looking forward to seeing where this is going.
These are always very clever.
He certainly doesn't just crank these out.
There is nothing like a day, nothing in the world.
In Australia, we learned what the recent doomed attempt by former Prime Minister and massive onion-eating weirdo Tony Abbott to bring back imperial honours was actually worth. $135,000, the value ascribed to a set of medals which were yet to be draped around the collar of some lucky dame or knight by the time the scheme was mercifully binned by Abbott's successor. We also learned, after looking into what this most ex of Australian ex-Prime Ministers is up to these days, that Tony Abbott is also at the centre of another controversy for having twice in recent months been given permission to leave Australia when many of his fellow citizens cannot. It seems pretty clear what Australia's government is attempting here, and it's hard to see why anyone is complaining. If everyone doesn't shut up, even Tony Abbott will figure this out. We learned that Florida, already beloved by newscasters the world over as the "and finally" state, is not merely diligently upholding its commitment to furnishing bizarre and or idiotic news stories, but has branched out further into providing open goals for avian puns.
Good, here we go again.
The Florida settlement of Lakeland has put a proportion of its swan population up for sale, fearing imminent overrun by the long-necked beak owners. Lakeland's swan plague originated in 1953 as a well-meaning gift from Queen Elizabeth II, who was moved by a letter from a local seeking sympathy for the fact that such swans as Lakeland possessed had been eaten by alligators. Whether out of genuine goodwill or subtle revenge for what America had done to her great-great-great-great, we think that's right, grandfather 177 years previously, QE2 sent a pair of royal swans, whose descendants now number an apparently unmanageable 86. You might say they've been...
Please not again.
...causing a flap.
Ugh, dear God, no.
Anyway, attentive listeners will recall being promised that the earlier item about an outbreak of bipartisan good fellowship in Utah was being wheeled out as the setup to a looming payoff. So we also learned this week that, grim though the prospect of US President Benito Cartman winning re-election on November 3rd is, it might be even worse than we dare imagine. And we learned this from one of the president's most indefatigable supporters, the bewilderingly influential televangelist and absolutely raging dingbat, Pat Robertson. In what Robertson appeared to believe was some sort of endorsement of Trump, he vouchsafed to his agog audience of elderly lunatics that God had informed him that the president's re-election would presage the actual apocalypse.
And what I think, very frankly, is that the only thing that will fulfill what the word of Jesus, and I'm going to give you in a minute, is some kind of an asteroid strike on the globe.
In fairness, this doesn't sound like the kind of thing God would just make up. So we learned that should Donald Trump be returned, we can anticipate the obliteration of humankind by a divinely ordained meteorite. This scenario is what is known in military circles by the three-letter acronym SSP, for Self-Solving Problem. For Monocle 24, I'm Andrew Muller.
Thanks, Andrew. And still to come on the show, we head to Portugal for a look at Porto Fashion Week. We stop off in Paris for a tall story, and a top London chef shares a favorite recipe. Stay tuned.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
You are with The Curator, our weekly highlight show here on Monocle 24, and I am Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Last weekend, I was happy to welcome back to the stack Rob Pinney, editor of Point 51, and in the title exploring contemporary issues across Europe. The theme for issue 3 is resilience, with stories ranging from the demanding lives of shepherds in the mountains of northern Albania to a story about carers in Porto. Here is Rob with more.
So our last issue came out in November of last year, and we've been working on this issue since then. So we'd originally planned for it to come out in May of this year, but because of the nature of the reporting we do, it involves putting people on the ground, often for extended periods of time. It wasn't possible for us to ask people to continue to do that work. So we had to introduce a short delay. But I think it's made the issue stronger as a whole. The stories are relevant to the time and the moment that we're in a variety of different ways, but they're not all directly connected to the pandemic itself. So I think there's lots of value in it in a more lateral and connected sense too.
Well, and you're very right. I mean, your magazine, you know, it is about kind of in-depth reporting. You know, usually the writers, they have to go to the place where things are happening, or the photographer. And I'm glad that continues, because I know COVID brought so many challenges to you. But you're right, the variety of stories here is fantastic. I was very impressed. There's the story about the shepherds in the mountains of northern Albania. You know, something that I had no idea, but, you know, then you become so involved with their story reading your magazine.
That's a story by photographer and journalist Nixon Ogger, who is actually one of our contributing editors now, and we worked with him on the last issue as well. It's a story about a group of shepherds that live between the lowlands and then the higher pastures in the mountains of northern Albania. And they're one of the last remaining groups to practice something called transhumance, which is where you seasonally migrate flocks of sheep so they can graze on pastures at higher altitudes in the summer months. But it's also a story about, I mean, a very difficult and challenging way of life. It's very physically demanding. But then there's also a kind of, I guess, a beauty in that. And Nick explores that and contrasts it with his own experiences in the story as well.
Another very fascinating and emotional story is the one of the caregivers in Portugal. And, you know, although it's not entirely COVID-related, I mean, I think we can say that it is a little bit related, especially when we talk about the elderly being the most affected about this disease as well. But the photography, again, extremely emotional and very, you know, it feels that the photographer is very close to its subjects in a way.
Absolutely. So, I mean, this is a photo essay that we've been working on, well, for almost a year with Teresa, the photographer. It's a photo essay about her mother and grandfather, and her mother is an informal caregiver for her grandfather. She started shooting this, I mean, quite some time ago, and it wasn't supposed to be something that was COVID related or connected to the pandemic. But obviously, when lockdown measures were introduced in Portugal and in Porto, the city that she lives in, it brought a whole new dynamic to their lives within the four walls of their flat. But Teresa continued to photograph that for us throughout the lockdown period. And I mean, you're right, it's an emotional, raw, visceral account of that experience. But it's also extremely intimate and loving. And I mean, as Teresa says in the introduction to the piece, you know, her mum's one of about 800,000 informal and unpaid caregivers undertaking that work in Portugal, that she sees the body of work as ultimately a tribute to her mum and a kind of a testament to her strength and the things that she's going through.
Rob Pinney there, editor of Point 51 magazine, speaking with me for last weekend's edition of The Stack. to Portugal now as we catch up with the latest happenings in the Iberian nation's fashion scene. In Porto last week, established and up-and-coming designers presented their collections in person to a group of local and international press. Porto Fashion Week, now in its 25th year, is a platform to show inspiring looks for 2021 and spotlight the creative collaboration between designers and the country's famed textile producers. Monaco correspondent Ivan Carvalho caught runaway shows and visited local labels to send us this report.
Set on the banks of the Douro, the former customs house of the city of Porto transforms every 6 months into a venue to highlight the sharpest and smartest looks from Portugal's fashion scene. The sprawling riverside complex was the stage to shine the light on looks for spring. Designer Inês Torquato, who in December is launching a new line of casual basics next to her main label, focused on the themes of inclusion and the environment.
I'm working with some organics, some recycled, but I don't want to sell this marketing idea of the organic and the recycled. I want to search the origin of the product, because I found that working with a recycled polyester from bottles taken from the ocean, I bought it 2 years ago, thinking that was a great sustainability move, but I imported that from Italy. So I'm trying to work locally. My materials are from Portugal. My production is made in Portugal to try to reduce that impact. In this presentation, I had 6 models wearing white jeans. That material is from a company here in Portugal that's called Troficolor. It's an organic cotton, and they trace it from the origin of the thread to the final fabric. So the last 3 years, my work has been based around working for different body types and inclusion, human rights, and celebrating the differences we have. For my new commercial brand, Torquato, I will have 3 branches on the website. One of them is for basics, where you can find not your average white t-shirt, but a white t-shirt that has a silhouette that's adapted to fit several body types. The ultimate goal to this is the basic section, having everything you need in your wardrobes. So the basic white t-shirt, jeans, khakis, overshirt, shirt, and everything in a basic way, without flashy colors or prints, just white, black, grays.
For London-based designers Marc Almeida, the duo opted to host their runway show outdoors at the newly opened World of Wine Museum. Their well-received women's collection, which showed oversized looks such as asymmetric hoodies and t-shirt dresses, further highlighted a trend towards monochromatic color schemes and simpler patterns, and featured a diverse mix of models of varying heights, hairstyles, and ethnicities. Designer Paulo Almeida.
We are very instinctive in the way we work. We never really follow any sort of rule. We are very inspired by the girls that we work with. We call them the MA girls. And we just are very obsessed now about this idea of, well, we were always like that, really, that we are very obsessed about the idea of all these different personalities combined into this massive mashup of identity, which we somehow try to organize in this lineup of a collection that to hopefully make some sense in the end. But it's just about different personalities and attitudes all combined together. We're very obsessed now also with the idea of responsibility, social and ecological, and we are just focusing on a new segment of our label that's called Remade, which is basically the most sustainable project that we have been doing so far. So we only have natural materials, so natural fibers, or if synthetic, they are actually made out of recycled materials. So we have polyester, for example. We like these extreme colors, and pink is always a favorite. So we always end up having something like that. It's just quite signature, really. We are very lucky to have an amazing network of suppliers in Portugal. Our collection is 100% made in Portugal. And to be honest, we are so blessed. It's just really good.
Beyond the catwalk, Porto is the base for a number of talented menswear labels, boasting monobrand stores, including Portuguese Flannel, Daily Day, and La Paz. The latter has developed a cult following, thanks to its casual line of garments, inspired by the sun, sea, and surf. José Abreu, co-owner of La Paz.
Fall winter 21, we've been south designing the collection, so the inspiration is pretty much the Portuguese coast. There's a lot of greens and pastels, so we did a lot of mid-season pieces, introducing a bunch of new models, overshirts, and something that people can use between seasons. It's like, it's not like very marked in terms of the weather.
After 3 days of shows, Portugal Fashion Week left visitors optimistic about the future. The emphasis on locally sourced, high-quality, long-lasting materials is a good strategy to pursue no matter the season. For Monocle, in Porto, I'm Ivan Carvalho.
Monocle correspondent Ivan Carvalho there for the latest edition of Monocle on Design. Staying with architecture and design now for the latest episode of Tall Stories. This week we visit one of Paris' many overlooked architectural treasures, the Orgues de Flandre, a musically inspired set of post-war buildings nestled deep in the northeastern part of the city. Monaco's Charlie Fumercourt spoke to Raphael Bidot Waddington, a local artist, writer and researcher, to find out more about this unique part of the Parisian skyline.
Take a walk down the Avenue de Flandre in Paris's 19th arrondissement, and you'll be met with surroundings that you wouldn't associate with your typical Parisian boulevard. In place of the much-adored Haussmannian architecture is something a little more modern, a little more austere. In fact, emerge from one of the Avenue's many metro stations, and you're more likely to feel like you were in Berlin as opposed to the French capital. One set of buildings that personifies this unique mélange of architecture are the Orgues de Flandre, a hulking set of towers that are instantly noticeable for their striking angular shapes. Raphael Bidot Waddington is an artist and author whose apartment and studio looks out onto this extraordinary but lesser-known part of the Parisian skyline. I spoke to her about both the history and the role of these unique structures and began by asking her how they got their rather strange name.
The building has really the shape of an organ, like, you know, those giant musical instruments in churches. So it's really like a very literal use of the name, like the Les Orgues de France, the organ of Flandre, which is like a northern region of France and Belgium. And it looks like the instrument, and the building itself is inspired by musical movements. So you have like the sonat, because it's there is four or five buildings together. It's like a micro city. So each of the towers have a musical name also, but Les Orgues, it's very literal use of the name. It is still a social housing, and apparently it was built in the late 70s. The architect is Martin Schulz von Trick. He's a German architect. And La Cité, the city, it was replacing another one, which was called Cité des Flamands, the Flemish city.
Now, it isn't just the Avenue de Flandre that possesses this rather un-Parisian aesthetic, but much of the 19th arrondissement. According to Bidot Waddington, much of this is down to rebuilding in the post-war years that saw numerous social housing projects developed in this part of the city.
This part of Paris, the 19th arrondissement, is a part of Paris which is already somehow at the periphery in regards to the center of the city, and we're pretty close to the peripheric. And this part of Paris has been massively rebuilt in the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s. It's still being built with really important urban design projects. So it's true that it has a very different urban atmosphere and architecture than the center of Paris. Like, there is very little Haussmannian buildings. Paris has this core of architecture with Haussmannian style, but otherwise there is a very strong tradition of supporting architecture of all epochs in Paris, even in the suburbs. So when I say that Les Orgues are part of the cultural patrimony and the cultural capital of Paris, it clearly is. It's more that foreigners tend to visit the center of Paris and do not come so much in the outskirts of Paris, even less in the suburb. But yes, it's more, you know, the cliché of Paris that are so strong that people keep on being interested in its own caricature, I would say.
One of Paris's main allures will always be its famous skyline. This is due in large part to strict planning and height restrictions on new buildings, allowing you to observe the great landmarks from viewpoints across the city with remarkable ease. It also means, unlike most vast urban centres, that towers and tall buildings are few and far between, with a few exceptions to this rule proving particularly unpopular with Parisians anyway. The Arc de Flandre are no different and are not looked upon favourably by everyone, although this is beginning to change.
I think now there is a proper recognition that there is an architectural signature, so the building is worth being kept and it's part of the patrimony and the cultural assets of the city. So now I think there is a full recognition of that cultural value of the buildings. Then they still remain in the aesthetic of those housing prospects. The building has been entirely renovated not that long ago, so it's kind of like fresher, but it still has that feeling of sometimes insecurity or dodginess, and so there is different viewpoint on the building. I think you might have Parisians saying they like very much the building, but then you have people who are living inside who are suffering from insecurity, or some of the building are still quite deteriorated. So, you know, you might have like very mixed feeling about those buildings for sure.
Personally, for Bido Waddington, the Arc de Flandre hold a special place in her heart. With a studio window that gazes onto the buildings, they offer a welcome break from typical Parisian architecture, providing an important source of daily creative inspiration and something just, well, a little different.
I really like that neighborhood. I really like to have that kind of urban landscape. I think it creates a very unusual skyline for a Parisianer to have the Arc, but in the surrounding, there is quite a few other towers and 70s building and 80s buildings, which has a quite extravagant architectural style. So I find it extremely exciting and inspiring somehow to have that landscape.
The artist, writer and researcher Raphael Bido Waddington in conversation with Monaco's Charlie Filmer Court for this week's edition of Tall Stories. We're nearing the end of the show, but we have time for one more highlight, and it's a perfect one for the weekend, as our next item comes from the latest edition of Food Neighborhoods. Laura Jackson, the chef behind East London's Towpath Cafe, shares one of her hit recipes with us. Here is Laura.
My name is Laura Jackson. I'm the head chef and co-owner of Towpath, which is on the Regent's Canal in East London. And I'd like to share one of my favourite recipes with you today, which is roast chicken. Obviously a very, very simple recipe, but I think one that is quite hard to pull off properly. And I've roasted a lot of chickens in my life, so I think by now I think I've got the recipe down to a T. It's a great one to cook at home because it is so simple and it's a crowd pleaser, so it's quick to prepare. And the reason I chose this recipe is because, well, one, it is totally delicious, but for me, my sort of philosophy and the way I love to cook is not wasting anything. And the great thing about roast chicken is once you've served the chicken, you can then make a stock with the carcass, which allows you to make lots of different stews and soups and broths. And then there's also tends to be quite a lot of meat that you miss from carving, which can then be used for another thing. So essentially you can get three or four dishes from one thing, which makes me very, very happy. So all you need to do is get a roast chicken. Obviously, I would say definitely to get a chicken that has had a good life, so free range or organic or from a farm where you know that they're having a nice time. And I used to always roast my chickens with butter, but then maybe 7 or 8 years ago I had to give up dairy. I had some health issues, so I switched to using olive oil, and actually feel that it is much better than using butter because the crispiness of the skin, you can take it to another level because the burning properties of olive oil are much lower than butter. So I would definitely go for olive oil. For one chicken, you definitely want one big juicy lemon and then a head of garlic. If you've got some tarragon or bay leaves to stuff up its bum, you can do that as well, but that's not a huge thing. So really, it's super, super simple. What you want to do first is get your oven, I would say, almost as hot as possible. Obviously, if you've got a very strong oven, I would do it at about kind of 220, 230. And then I would cut the garlic in half and stick it up its bum with some bay leaves and tarragon if you have. Cut the lemon in half, squeeze it, get all the juice out that you can possibly get out and squeeze it all over the chicken. And again, I then put the lemon up its bum. It just cooks more evenly if you've got lots of things stuffed up inside it. Then I put lots of pepper and some molten sea salt and then a really, really generous glug of olive oil. Then just get your hands in and just rub it all over and then pop it in the oven, breast side up. And I do between 25 to 35 minutes at a super, super high heat. Basically, this is the stage where you want the skin to go really, really crispy. So anywhere between that time. And then once the skin is super crispy, you want to turn the heat down really, really low. So I turn it down to about 140, 150, and then cook it for another 25 to 35 minutes. So in total, you want to cook the chicken for an hour. So if it's super high for 25, then you do low for 35, or vice versa. And then you basically take it out. I don't baste it or touch it during its cooking and let it rest for a good 20 minutes to half an hour, and then it's good to go.
The chef Laura Jackson of Hackney's Towpath Cafe there for this week's edition of Food Neighborhoods. Well, that's all we've got time for this week's edition of The Curator. The show is produced by the lovely San Impi and presented by me, Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Join us again next week to hear some of the very best of the programs here on Monaco 24. Thanks for listening.